believe that my charge actually was observe Starfar mission laws in galaxies. I'm going to actually try to use two of these for change. Let's see how it works. My Starfar mission law, the relationship between the Starfar mission rate and the large scale properties of the interstellar medium or the properties of the galaxies themselves. There are many motivations for attacking this problem. And by the way, I'm going to mix a review. I was asked to do a review with a lot of sprinkling of results that Crystal Martin and I have been working on. Crystal's sitting in the back here today. In the context of this meeting, clearly the third bullet is the key one. Everyone doing these semi-analytical numerical models wants a recipe for turning gas into stars. And we would like to, on the basis of observations, see whether there are any simple prescriptions that work. However, the motivation is much deeper than that. We'd like, clearly, this problem is relevant to understanding the Hubble sequence. It's relevant to understanding starbursts. I just want to remind you what kind of dynamic range we have to address in galaxies. You can express that in any way. These are three galaxies that sort of represent the extremes, at least in terms of, say, star formation rate per unit area within the confines of the star-forming region, where the Milky Way sort of plunk in the middle in log space, objects like Malin 1 or gas-rich S0 galaxies at one extreme, ultra-luminous starbursts that we now know are largely powered by starbursts like RQ20 at the other. There's actually a range of about at least 7 orders of magnitude in star formation rate per unit area. The rate in terms of star formation rate per unit mass across the Hubble sequence is essentially from zero, of course, in early type S0 galaxies through regulars. And we would like to know whether over that vast dynamic range there are any simple scaling laws. And the first approximation, purely from an empirical point of view, can we make any sense of this in terms of simple scaling laws? And by looking at the behavior of those laws across this range of environments, we may learn something about the extent to which the star formation rate is regulated by global properties, external properties, the galaxy, environmental properties, as opposed to perhaps entirely local descriptions. And I think the message that's going to come out of this talk is that we've made a lot of progress on the empirical side, putting together recipes. We've made almost no progress toward understanding them physically, although it would be nice someday to be able to do that. If anything, we're creeping backwards. The simple picture, the explanations we thought that worked don't seem to work as well as they did a decade ago. On the other hand, these recipes are very simple, and they seem to work better than you would ever expect simple recipes to work. So we are making progress in a fashion, I think. Here's a view graph that summarizes most of what I'll talk about today. Over this full dynamic range of gas density and star formation rate per unit area, what's plotted is this is for a set of galaxies with essentially each, the lower part are a set of nearby spiral galaxies in which there are anywhere from about 5 to a dozen positions in each galaxy. The relationship between the star formation rate per unit area in the case of these galaxies from H alpha plotted against essentially the column density of gas, the surface density of both molecular and atomic hydrogen added together. And then the solid points are infrared-derived star formation rates for nuclear starbursts in nearby galaxies. I'll talk about this at the end of the talk. But you see essentially two regimes, a power law regime above a certain density in which, in fact, the rate appears to be well represented by a Schmidt law, power law relation. The best fitting slope here is about 1.4, plus or minus 0.1 or so. And then in most of these objects, there's another regime. This power law does not extend to zero density. You reach a finite gas surface density in which there's a turnover in the star formation rate threshold. And I'm going to talk about the two of them individually, starting with the threshold. Now I will go to the two-view graph system. Let's see if you can actually see that. kind of. Thresholds have been recognized for about 20 years. And what I want to emphasize here is that what we've learned new about thresholds in the last few years. They're seen in several contexts in galaxies. The most obvious one, most evident one, and the easiest one to demonstrate is that in most spirals, there's a radial cutoff, or I shouldn't say cutoff, because it was a turnover, a radius at which the star formation rate turns over abruptly. This is an HLF image of NGC 4647. It is the single best example I've ever seen on imaging 500 galaxies, so let's call it typical. The gas extends, this object extends to about the size of the ViewGraph screen. Let me impress for you that this cutoff is not caused by a cutoff in the interstellar medium. Another example requires two ViewGraphs to show. This is M83, NGC 5236, Southern Hemisphere. This is just a very deep, two stretches of the same H-alpha image. You can see a very complex structure within the galaxy. But again, I think most of you or most of your sons and daughters could point their finger at this and say there seems to be a radius at which most of the H-alpha emission is confined. Let me now show you the same galaxy, but overlaying on a H1 contour map of M83. And you can see, in fact, the radius within which most of the star formation is confined confines only a small fraction of the ISM. Clearly, something is going on out here. You do find some bits of star formation, usually at large radii. I'll come back to that in a minute. But there is a transition of nonlinearity, and that nonlinearity is very important for producing some of the nonlinear behaviors we see in galaxies, flare-ups and star formation rating interactions, perhaps arm-inter-arm contrast in galaxies and so forth. If you actually quantify this, I'm going to get to discuss this in a little more detail in a few minutes, but here's a subsample. Here are what these turnovers look like when quantified in terms of radial surface brightness profiles of galaxies. So this is a sample Crystal and I put together, I think in this case probably about a little more than a dozen, maybe 15 spirals in Virgo. What is plotted are radial surface brightness profiles of H-alpha, just an intensity scale here. Notice the log scale, so there's a lot of dynamic range in the plot. As a function of radius, and in each case, the radius has been normalized to essentially the edge, as tracked by some software that Crystal wrote to essentially do this in an automated way. And what you see again is this is a log linear plot. So in fact, disks of galaxies are at least these objects. Many on average, the ensembles roughly has exponential profile in the star formation rate per unit area, and then there is a turnover. And this is essentially the detection limit down here. These aren't finite measurements. And you can see in some cases the thresholds are very sharp. NGC 4647 will essentially fall right off the edge. But sometimes it's a little dirtier than that. No, this is H-alpha, star formation rate per unit area. And in each of these, if I were to overlay, well, in the case of Virgo, it's complicated because of environmental effects in Virgo. But in most cases, I would say the mean ratio of H1 diameter to this diameter in this sample of objects is probably around 1.6 to 1.8. In the field, it's more like 3. So this is way, way within the disk. And I'll come back and talk about that a little more in a minute. These radii are usually, sometimes but not always, roughly R25, roughly the devocular diameter that you would measure. In some cases, especially in Virgo, they're at about a half, they're well inside. We actually see a cutoff well within the photometric radius of the galaxy. Okay. I'll come back and talk about these more in a second because it isn't quite as simple as I've described, but I just want to briefly mention that there are other manifestations of thresholds observed, not just in terms of these edges. In fact, let me show you one more set, just so you know I haven't picked here several other examples. Now, again, deep stretched images. In each case, the ellipse is the threshold radius that the software identified. And you can see, in fact, it isn't quite as simple a story as I've described for you. I forget, this looks suspiciously like, no, that might even be M83 up there. You can see cases where there's very little of star formation outside, but it isn't an absolute, kind of, it's simply a turnover within a gradually declining, a disk with a gradually declining gas density. But there are other cases where it's downright dirty. There's plenty of spiral arms extending outside. In this case, the software became extremely confused, partly because it got to the end of its CCD chip. But even in this case, in fact, there are cases where there is no well-defined transition. This was pointed out in the literature, I think, the first time by Ferguson, Wise, and Gallagher, and they're absolutely right. It isn't always clean in that way. In fact, in our data, this is all from Martin and Kennicott, we even see hints that things are a lot cleaner in, say, the Virgo cluster than they are in field spirals. About half our samples roughly equally divided between Virgo and field spirals. Sample, by the way, was defined to be everything that had in the literature at the time the data were taken, spatially resolved measurements, aperture synthesis H1 measurements, and multi-beam CO measurements across the disks. And Jeff Kenny's thesis sample in Virgo still makes up a big part of that sample. It may be that because of the environmental, the special environment in Virgo, which in the outer parts of the H1 disk, so most of the spirals have been removed to one degree or another, things are a little bit simpler. It's a lot dirtier in the field, but you do see cutoffs in most cases. Now, but there are other evidences of thresholds. Malin 1 is a classic example. Here's an aid to remind you what Malin 1 is. I won't call it prototypical, the extreme of all time, low surface brightness spiral, a galaxy with a scale length, well, with an H1 disk that's nearly 100 kiloparsecs in diameter. If I overlay an optical image on the same scale, I can probably, oh, there, this is going to be that, with a velocity field barely seen. There is some star formation scattered within the disk, but it's a very low, the rate of star formation per unit gas mass is down, factors of orders of magnitude, about order of magnitude at least, relative to nearby galaxies. As the view graph over there shows, documents, there have been several studies of this phenomenon. Low surface brightness spirals, by and large, not universally, but as a class, seem to have very little star formation relative to their total gas content. There's a whole class of early type spirals, mainly S0 galaxies, that have H1 masses, many of them larger than the H1, the interstellar mass in the Milky Way, yet negligible near zero star formation rates. And in Magellanic Irregulars, DDO-154, for example, has an enormous H1 disk representing, I think, 90% of the baryonic mass in the galaxy. And just a smattering of faint H2 regions within that gas. The common feature in all of these systems is that although they have large fractional gas contents relative to the stars, in all of the cases, the gas is very extended. The surface densities are very low. That is probably the key to what's triggering these thresholds. On the other hand, things have gotten murkier. There are several situations in which thresholds may be important, but it isn't all clear now whether that is the case. It had been claimed for many years, including papers I've written, that thresholds may well be responsible for the strong arm interarm contrast. You see the segregation of star formation in galaxies like M51 here. However, as molecular line observations have improved in these galaxies. Here's an image of M51 from the Bema Song survey. We're now finding, in fact, that the molecular gas is nearly as segregated into the arms as well. So what was once thought to be a threshold phenomenon may simply be due to the way in which clouds coalesce in spiral arms. Likewise, it isn't clear in interacting galaxies, the flashes of starbursts in interacting galaxies, whether thresholds are involved there or not. The favored model, well, my favored model anyway, for explaining these is Q instabilities in the disk. Just take the simplest model at least I could think of 10 years ago, which is a treat the gas disk as a isothermal sheet, apply the classical Thumare criterion, and ask whether, in fact, whether the radio cutoffs in star formation could be associated with a transition in Q going from one end to the other. The reason you can test, you have any hope of testing models like this, is that there's a big dynamic range in the densities at which the thresholds occur. I'll show you a blow-up of the plot from earlier. The thresholds don't always occur at the same density. In fact, in our sample, there's at least an order of magnitude dynamic range in absolute gas density, and likewise ranges in the individual atomic and molecular gas densities. This is again something from Martin and Kennicott. It shows for our new sample, essentially for each object at the threshold radius, what the gas density is, and then what the fraction of that density in atomic hydrogen is, ratio essentially of H1 to H1 plus H Arabic 2 at the threshold radius. And you can see the threshold densities have a large dynamic range, and in fact sometimes they occur in purely atomic disks, well within, outside the edge of the molecular disk, but sometimes they occur smack in the middle of the molecular disk as well. So it isn't, what we are seeing are not necessarily transitions in the formation of molecular clouds. It's something distinct from that. It may have something to do with it, but something different. The Q model works pretty well, but has serious flaws to it. Old plot from over 10 years ago. This shows the run of Q in a set of SC galaxies with strong radial cutoffs in the star formation, essentially the reciprocal of Q as a function of radius. Again, with the same kind of plot as before, with the radial scale normalized to the observed threshold radius. There are two reasons to believe that gravitational stabilities qualitatively can account for what we're seeing. One is that, in fact, the dispersion you see in Q at any one radius is considerably smaller than the actual dispersion in threshold radii. The Q model does a very passable job of accounting for both the densities and the radii at these thresholds. The other reason is that the gas disk was actually pointed out by Quirk in the 1970s, that in fact gas disks, the radial profile distribution of gas and disks is roughly in a Q, a quasi-stable Q of 1 plus or minus the factor of 2 configuration over the visible disks of most galaxies. And that's what you'd expect from self-regulation. If star formation cuts off when the gas disk becomes Q stable, of course it will tend to hover around that value, be locked in by the feedback of the star formation. So I would argue, at least in a hand-waving fashion, those are the two strongest arguments in favor of this model working. However, the more data we get, the worse this model performs. So we went back, got better data, got lots more data, no longer selected out of the Hubble Atlas, but a gas selected set of galaxies. This is the run of Q at the threshold. It still works. The dispersion in late type spirals, by the way, this is essentially the ratio, the reciprocal of Q at the threshold radius. There's a scaling factor because you don't know what the gas velocity dispersion is. If we assume that all gas disks have constant velocity dispersion about 6 kilometers a second, you get a Q value about 1.4, 0.7 on this plot. And it certainly has much lower dispersion than the dispersion in absolute threshold densities or molecular fractions or anything else. When you go to early type galaxies, however, there's some evidence that the best fitting value of Q was higher by a factor of about 1.5. And you look at the ensemble as a whole, and things begin to turn into a mess. These are preliminary results, and we're worried about these types of galaxies. Many of them don't show very well-defined thresholds. In fact, they tend to be Q-stable over most of their radii in many cases. So this is not it's a poorly posed test. But the same phenomenon has been seen by Deidre Hunter and collaborators. They've looked at a set of Magellanic irregulars, and they also find, although there are clear observed thresholds in those galaxies, the value of Q that best fits their data differs from the one from late type spirals by about a factor of 2. In addition, the Q model simply breaks down entirely in certain types of galaxies. In late type galaxies, M33, NGC 2403, NGC 300, what you find is that the Q model predicts that those disks are stable at nearly all radii, yet they have as intense star formation as any other galaxy of their morphological type. There are a couple of possible explanations. These tend to be metal-poor galaxies. It may be the CO emission in those galaxies underestimates the gas content, so Q is being, overestimated. Gas densities would be underestimated. Or it turns out all of those the galaxies in which this model breaks down all seem to be ones with rising rotation curves within the disk in which the model is being tested. And it could be that, in fact, the criterion for setting these thresholds is gravitational, a Roche criterion, some kind of shear criterion, but that the simple Tumre criterion, stability against radial ring-like modes or spiral modes, simply isn't the appropriate one to apply. So the way I would sort of conclude this section is to say that qualitatively, clearly there are thresholds, and that I think, at least myself, gravitational stability is at the core of it, at least in most objects, present-day massive galaxies. But in fact, it isn't at all the entire story. There are complications. Those complications are awfully hard to test observationally now. But this is probably a recipe. It's certainly better to apply a recipe like this in your simulations than to ignore thresholds altogether. But you caveat emptor in the details. Okay, so that leaves us now quickly to move on from the threshold regime to what about the regime above threshold. And now I'm going to show you results from two recent studies. This is again from Martin and Kennicott. I'll show you actually a couple versions of this plot. Once you are above the threshold, there's something remarkable here. You can see, even though we're plotting, I think, 22 or 23 galaxies, at any given gas surface density above threshold, they all have very roughly the same star formation rate per unit area. And these are measured from H alpha surface brightnesses. They're not corrected for anything, extinction, anything at all. There should be at least that much scatter just observationally from extinction variations. So indeed, there does seem to be something universal. You do have points that are above, but in fact, these are nuclei. In each case, these terminations are nuclei of galaxies where you have other processes contributing to the H alpha emission. The same kind of analysis has been done recently by Round and Young at UMass using the Five College Survey. They have a larger sample of galaxies measured in CO, and they also have H-alpha imaging from NOAO, and what they have done is plotted H-alpha surface density essentially against only, in this case, molecular surface density. It differs from the other plot in the sense we were plotting total gas density. They only have CO data. They're looking at the dependence on CO surface brightness, or if you believe in universal conversions, on the surface density of molecular gas. And once again, you see quite a strong correlation, especially when you look at prune sample to undisturbed objects, based on objects where they have good, they can control the geometry. The best fitting slope to this relation is between 1.2 and 1.4, depending on which sample you look at. They argue that it's consistent with a linear relation, which is the slope of these lines within the errors. But it is roughly consistent with what's been seen before in terms of the integrated properties of disks. here is our data again. It's the same plot as I showed before, but showing each data point you can compare with the previous relation. The red line is the relationship between, I think for a sample of 60 nearby galaxies, the relationship between the integrated star formation rate per unit area within the entire star-forming disks with the mean gas density within disks. And since, in part, that this relation was derived from these, you shouldn't be surprised that the fits overlay each other quite well. But in fact, it's still reassuring. So for the modelers, the good news is that a Schmidt law appears to work not only as a single zone description of the mean star formation within an entire galaxy, but actually seems to work out of roughly the 1 kiloparsec scale within individual disks as well. This is a 1.4 slope line. Okay, good. The other good news to come out of this is that the zero point of this relationship seems to be insensitive, perhaps entirely insensitive, to any of the parent properties of the galaxies themselves. This is back again to Round and Young, but it shows essentially the mean zero point. In each case, the best fitting, well, this is the ratio of star H alpha surface brightness to CO surface brightness for galaxies broken down in different ways. And you can see, in fact, the dependence there is a very weak dependence on Hubble type that is essentially mapping that slightly nonlinear Schmidt law on top. And there's something going on in the mergers, but they have essentially no data there. And H alpha doesn't work here anyway. It's a crummy star formation indicator. But in fact, it looks like this relationship not only is a fairly straightforward one with a small scatter within individual galaxies, but it doesn't seem to be very strongly dependent on the bulk properties of the galaxies themselves. Now, unfortunately, these kinds of tests are self-limiting in terms of surface density. If you adopt a standard dust-to-gas ratio for disks, you expect for surface densities greater than about a couple hundred solar masses to square parsec. AV, the extinction actually at H-alpha, rises to above a couple of magnitudes. So in fact, H-alpha no longer serves as a reliable star formation indicator, at least for a uniform screen geometry. So if you want to probe this relationship to higher densities, you have to go to another sample and use another method. And the way you can do that is look at infrared luminous starbursts, just one example, M82. I think you all know about these are objects that are characterized by almost entirely dust-obscured star formation, which often is concentrated in a very high surface density molecular disk in the center of the objects. And so we can look at the same relationship for those. In this case, use CO maps to get the mean surface density of gas within the zone, and use the infrared. You can either use the bracket gamma luminosity if it's available, or the far infrared luminosity to get the star formation rate per unit area. Infrared works great for this because these objects are so dust obscured that essentially infrared measures the bolometric luminosity of the region. They're so young that young stars dominate the bolometric luminosity. So you're measuring a star formation rate based on, you're essentially counting the number of hydrogen atoms being fused in these regions. As long as there's not an AGN involved, it is the ultimately robust star formation indicator. And what you see then is the same kind of relationship, surface density now of molecular hydrogen. These things are 99% molecular or more, so that's safe. Star formation rate per unit area. The scales were all shifted up by a few orders of magnitude. But in fact, this is now another Schmidt law, consistent with Schmidt law, slope 1.4. I'll just mention in passing one other point. These are lines of constant star formation efficiency. This one up here is essentially a star formation rate in which all of the gas will be consumed in 10 to the 8 years. In fact, if you express that in terms of absolute masses, many of the objects in the sample sit up in this part of the diagram up here. These are objects in which essentially billions of solar masses of hydrogen massive interstellar hydrogen comparable to the entire ISM of our Milky Way has been transported to the central kiloparsec. And this red line is the line, essentially the limiting line. An object on this line would be forming stars with 100% efficiency on the time scale of about 10 to the 8 years it would take to feed the gas into the center. So this is in some ways an ELS limit. And most of the objects in this sample are sitting there. So you don't get any more efficient star formation than that. And to jump to the bottom line, I think most of you have seen this as a couple-year-old result. This is what happens when you lay those infrared-selected galaxies on the same axis as spirals that I talked about earlier. These are the central parts, points in each spiral. These are the disk average relations. In fact, there's a single Schmidt law. In this case, the slope is 1.4, again, 1.39, I think, is this line, that actually can reproduce the entire range of behavior. There is a scatter about the relationship that's substantial, plus or minus a factor of 3 or so, but given the systematic errors in each of these measurements, in fact, you would not expect a scatter much smaller than this. No, I'm not saying that the relationship is perfectly tight in nature, I'm just saying these data can't, in fact, test this law any better. There are other laws that work equally well. Here's another relation. I don't know what to call this thing, a kinematic star formation law or an orbital law. It plots the same star formation rates, but instead of as a function of log of the gas density and allowing you to fit a free slope, this is simply the ratio of the local gas density to one orbital time scale at, I think, 7/10 of the outer edge of the disk, sort of the average orbit time within that disk. In other words, sigma times omega. If, in fact, the star formation rate was dictated by the ratio of gas density to local dynamical time scale, you predict a relationship, and this is not, the slope of this line isn't free, it's a line of slope 1, and we've simply shifted to 0 point to fit these objects, and you can see it works nearly as well. In fact, this dynamical model, if you look at within individual nearby galaxies, it actually fits the observations that we have better than a Schmidt law does. Alveo is just going to kill me in about a minute here, so yeah, can't do it. I see it. I see the red down there. There we go. Series of the same data. The upper plot is log star formation rate versus log gas density, and here is gas density set sigma omega. In fact, there's more nonlinearity in the relationship. The slope of 1 doesn't fit as well, but we were free to fit a slope in this case when we weren't in this one. The actual scatter is better. So those of you who need recipes, here are two recipes that work perfectly well. I'm done. I will just close with a listing of recipes here. The two I've just described are up here. Either one will work fine in your simulation. If you have a simulation that can predict gas distributions with any reliability. The literature is full of others. In fact, there's a second view graph of these. I won't have time. Given the company you keep, you'll probably be glad that your model isn't listed with the rest of these. Most of these are very specific, many of them untestable, but at least to the extent, and they require things like three-dimensional knowledge of the shapes of the galaxies, scale heights, or magnetic, the ICM densities, the temperature of the gas, and so forth. All I can say is real simple seems to work in this game, and I have to believe that there is physical meaning in that. It may mean that what regulates the rate is as simple as the efficiency of star formation within a given cloud, and what we're seeing is star formation regulated by the building time scale, or it could be the simple gravitational model, which predicts a 1.5 Schmidt law, which is consistent with what we observe. Either way, this is progress, not much progress in the theoretical sense for ITP, I'm afraid, but at least on the observational side, some clear signals that we can get a handle on this problem if we keep working at it. Thank you.
So, can we say that there is no dichotomy between disk quiescent star formation and star star formation models? Does continuity And what matters is the amount of gas which is available.
I can give you two hand-waving, we can think of it as continuous in two ways. The reason starbursts have a higher star formation efficiency is because in those mergers, the interstellar medium is compressed to mean densities that are typically 100 to 1,000 times higher. So the star formation rate per unit mass goes up over an order of magnitude under Schmidt law. That's one. The other possibility is it's entirely local. You got to talk to the people who do star formation on the Orion scale. It's simply that every time you create an giant molecular cloud by hook or crook, it makes 5% of its gas into stars. And the reason it happens faster in the starbursts is that the cycle time for making and building those clouds in orbit time is 10 times faster, 50 times faster. You tell me. But you don't need fancy bimodal anything.
Do you think there's any prospects for testing these star formation laws at higher redshifts? One of the problems we have is that if we want to convert a fixed amount of gas into stars on orbital time, things get denser in these hierarchical models at high redshifts, yet we would like galaxies to be more gas-rich at high redshifts for various reasons, which it would be seen rather difficult if we simply applied your recipe to get an evolution of that effect.
Right.
So, is there any way that one could do CO and star formation at higher redshifts?
Well, I should defer to the experts in the subject. Yes, CO at higher redshift, at least the higher order transitions are accessible. Michael, you have that coming up? Okay, another. So, yeah, I think you can observe CO simply moving up to higher order transitions, rotational transitions. With redshift, 21 centimeters is rough because you go way out of the band, and it's your cell phone, Garth Ellingworth's cell phone, that's going to interfere with your observation. But certainly, I think square kilometer array and MMA are partly being built with those things in mind. But there are experts in the audience who really should address that. Far more than that, I do about it. Right now, it's tough.
My question has to do with over what scales these rules apply, because it seems to me that this has to break down on some small scale where the very fact of making stars will use up the gas. So
yes.
In some sense, you actually expect an anti-correlation rather than a correlation.
Yes.
And you've, of course, averaged these things to death by, I guess, going around and taking azimuthal averages and so forth. Do you have a sense? I mean, have you varied the scale over which you look for these laws to see where it breaks down?
Yeah, as a young professor, I wasted the semester of a couple of students by looking at a few nearby the Magellanic Clouds, M33, and a few other galaxies where you have exquisite resolution. 50 parsec resolution, and we plotted Schmidt laws, local H alpha, local blue counts, on a point by point basis at thousands of points. In fact, the literature is full of such papers. What you get is essentially a scatter diagram. I didn't bring it with me, but you get a scatter plot, which if you run through a bivariate least squares fitter will give you a Schmidt law of 1.5 to 2. So there may be, you're absolutely right that once you have come to the scale of a cloud or a cloud complex, other physics comes into play. You have to think of the star formation law as a description of a phenomenon. Different scales probe different processes. I think on the kiloparsec scale, to the integrated scale, you're looking at the scales that are most relevant to modeling galaxy evolution. So that's the direction we moved. I think this is the wave of the future. Present studies have been limited by the fact that almost all of the CO data were single dish observations or interferometer measurements which lacked short spacings, so you didn't look at total power. This is a large consortium of observers. The BEMA is doing a sample of about 45 nearby spirals, and once they have a resolution, I think, of about, I believe it's 14 arc seconds or so. And this will allow us a fairly wide range of environments to look at these relationships on a point-by-point basis. There are a couple of grad students, Tony Wong, Kartik Sheth, in the group that are actually working on that pretty hard right now. So I think for the kinds of processes we're looking at, you're right, but where I think things break down entirely is essentially on about 50-person scale. You're looking at microphysics and what I call microphysics and individual